History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. By now we know they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take some initiative, to ask a few questions, and invest enough time to listen as memories from long, long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Every single veteran we've had the privilege of meeting over the years makes a unique impression on us. And when I realized today would be our 800th episode, I decided it might be a good time to zoom out and reflect just a little bit. So over the course of the next hour, we're going to look in the rearview mirror, but also look ahead, not only with a sneak peek of next week's episode, but also with a new twist on these World War II veteran stories that perhaps you can help bring into reality. We'll get to that a little later on, but 800 weeks after this show started on one station in Fresno, California, and almost 20 years after I first started interviewing veterans on TV, we are blessed to connect these amazing veteran stories to you all over the country over the airwaves and around the world online. I want to thank all of you who've suggested veterans for me to talk to over the years, and thanks most of all to the veterans and their families who've welcomed me into their homes all across America and who have also allowed us into their memories and their lives in such a powerful way. The very first episode of Hometown Heroes aired live on KMJ Radio in Fresno, California, with a retired middle school teacher named Augie Macaluso, plus a surprise guest that you'll hear as we all heard him live back then. Augie Macaluso grew up near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The son of a World War I veteran, he was studying engineering at Vanderbilt University as part of the Army Specialized Training Program when a shortage of infantrymen curtailed those studies and had him heading to Europe with the 106th Infantry Division.
We relieved the 2nd Infantry Division, the 23rd Regiment, and they had moved all the way up to the Siegfried Line, but then had to pull back because of the lack of supplies. But they had dug in pretty heavily, and they had good fortifications that we assumed. As they left, they said, "You lucky guys, you're in a quiet zone. You really have it made." Well, that didn't last very long.
December 16th.
Exactly 5:30 in the morning, December 16th, the German artillery opened up with a barrage that lasted for nearly an hour. If you would liken yourself to being in an aluminum or a metal shed and had somebody throwing gravel at you, that's what it sounded like when we were in this earthen bunker. There were our shells all around the area. Fortunately, there were no direct hits.
And the intelligence for the Americans, there had been a couple things that had been picked up that maybe could have indicated that that surprise attack was coming, a massive offensive with 250,000 German troops or what would become the Battle of the Bulge. But at that time, no one put all those pieces to the puzzle together to let you guys know that this was coming. You had no idea, right?
Well, not really. We didn't know about the massiveness. We knew that something was happening because we could hear sounds at night. The Germans flew a plane much like a small one-wing plane, because the noise that it sent up and down the line drowned out the movement of the Germans behind their lines. And they were moving tanks and infantry driven by trucks and horse-drawn in some cases up to get ready to have the original attack. We knew something was going to happen, but we had no idea it was going to be as massive as it was.
And you did all right the first day, surprised as you were, but it wasn't long before you ran into something that you weren't exactly prepared for, at least that you had no chance to fight against. Tell me about that.
That's true. The outfit to the left of us was overrun, and we in turn were overrun by the Germans. And directly in front of us was a minefield, heavily mined. It had been mined by the Germans when they withdrew. It was mined by the 2nd Infantry Division when they were there, and we were there long enough to put some mines out. So you didn't dare go out into that territory unless you had a guide who knew exactly where the mines were. So when the Germans came in and captured us, they told us that we, by putting Schmeisser machine pistols to our head, that we had to move across that minefield. Well, we were reluctant, But when you're looking at a Schmeisser machine pistol, you decide that you'd better go.
And that's what some people affectionately have dubbed, or maybe disaffectionately have dubbed, a burp gun, because in what sounds like one short burp, it can get off, what, 1,400 rounds a minute or something like that?
1,400 rounds a minute, that's true. In order to go across, we had to go over a double apron barbed wire fence. It was shaped like the letter A, with strands of barbed wire on each side. You had to pick your way over. As a result, I was the last one in the group, and I was the last one with a German right next to me. There were artillery shells coming in at that time because we had asked for close fire. These were American artillery shells. And the German who was right next to me was as frightened as I was. He ran up a number of yards in front of me, and when he did that, I moved off to the left as fast as I could and made a headlong dive into a snowbank.
Knowing full well that when you try something like that, they're liable to turn one of those Schmeissers on you and let loose, right?
Yes, I felt that that could happen at any second.
But it didn't.
Fortunately, no. And it was almost twilight, almost dusk at that time. And when I went in, I just didn't move. I stayed in position for endless amount of time. After about 3 or 4 hours, I looked around to see, pull my head out of the helmet, because my helmet had frozen in the snow. I pulled my head back and tried to locate where I was, but I couldn't get any direction at all. Finally, German artillery illuminated some of the buildings in the little village that we had been protecting, and I knew now what direction to go.
And that was the village of Heckescheid, I believe, correct?
Yes, it was. I had my fists, which were underneath me, were now frozen solid, so the only way I could find my way out was to put my fists into the footprints that I had made as I dove into that area. As I did that, my right hand hit something metallic, and I realized it was probably a mine called a Bouncing Betty or a Bouncing Betsy.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me another half hour to move after that, because I was really frightened when I realized I only missed that by a number of inches.
Now, you knew which direction you were heading in, but did you know who had control of that area where you were headed?
I did not know at that particular time. The only thing I did know, that about 50 yards on each side of me, I could hear Germans talking. So I'm now in the German lines. And before I made this burst to go across there, the American artillery started a fire in that area. So I had gone through a German artillery fire a couple of days before, and now I am enduring an American artillery fire. And the bits of shrapnel were coming right over me, and you could hear them just twisting and turning and singing as they would land in the snow. It really frightened me. When I hit that double apron barbed wire fence, running up to it, I felt as though I was running on my knees because my legs were so frozen. I hit that double log fence and flipped over and then began to run, expecting any minute to have bullets hitting me in the back because the Germans weren't that far from me. Apparently, they were as surprised as I was to be out there. As I got closer to the position that we had held before I was captured, I heard somebody say, halt.
Uh-oh.
Halt is the same in German as it is in English, but this one had a little bit of a southern tinge to it, and I knew it had to be Captain Comer, my captain from Alabama. It was, and I was home safe, at least for a while.
Prayers answered, at least for now.
Yes.
And you reported to him what had happened?
I reported to him what had happened. I told him about the position of the Germans, where they were firing, when they were firing. I told him what happened to our squad, that all had been captured, including myself, but I was the only one who got away. That included my squad leader, and my assistant squad leader. The assistant squad leader was wounded at the particular time when we were captured from those artillery shells that came in. I learned later that he died in a prisoner of war camp. But my sergeant, Sergeant Roberts, is alive. He survived, and I'm still in contact with him these many years later.
I want to talk about Sergeant Roberts. The day that the attack started, December 16th, he had a little problem with his wristwatch?
Yes, his GI watch malfunctioned. And he said to me, Mac, he referred to me as Mac, would you mind letting me have your wristwatch? And I was reluctant to do it because this had been a Christmas gift, an early Christmas gift to me, given to me by parents before we left to come overseas. And I said, yes, I'll give it to you, but whatever you do, please return it. Well, he was taken prisoner, and he was in prison until late May of 1945.
And in a POW camp, if you have something like a watch, that's going to be hard to keep without trading it in for something or out having it confiscated, I imagine.
Yes, he could have sold or given it away, sold it, whatever. He could have bribed the Germans with it. He could have had food, whatever he needed, he could have had if he would give up that watch. But he did not.
He did not, but you didn't get it back. And years passed. And at this point, I want to bring in another guest to the program. A little bit of a surprise for you here, Augie, someone who knows the story that we're talking about. We have Stuart Stern with us from Seattle, Washington. Stuart is an Academy Award-nominated screenwriter, won an Emmy Award for his work. But back in 1944, he was in Europe, too, with the 106th. And, Stuart, I understand that in 1977, you arranged a meeting between Augie and Sergeant Roberts.
I guess I did. It's hard to remember back that far. I remember the bulge better than 1977. Hi, Augie.
Hi, Stuart. This is a surprise. A real surprise. So good to hear you.
And maybe not as big a surprise as what happened at that dinner in 1977. Augie, tell us what you experienced while you were waiting for dessert.
Well, we were waiting for dessert. Sergeant Roberts leaned over to me and he said, Augie, I have something I want to give to you that I promised I would return. And at that moment, he gave me the watch. 33 years later, I had my watch back.
And it still works.
It still works. It's kept in a safe deposit box at the bank, but one of our children will get it eventually, I'm sure.
Stuart, I want to ask you, as the witness to that reunion of Augie and his watch, which obviously there are a few more things more important to him than his watch, but a pretty special moment for him at that point. Do you recall his reaction, the expression on his face, what that moment was like to be sitting there with him?
Well, it was a mixed moment. He was thrilled to get the watch, but not entirely thrilled about where it had been, because Sergeant Roberts, when he was captured by the Germans, knew that he had his honor pledged on protecting that watch. And the big question was where would he be able to hide it? And he finally, literally, found a place on his anatomy where that watch would be safe and where nobody could possibly have found it. And I don't think I'll go into details, but that watch has been to places that most of us have never been. Still, when he handed it to Augie, Augie was just thrilled to death.
Well, Augie conveniently left those details out the first time he told me about that, so I'm glad that you were able to bring the full depth of that story and the efforts to which Sergeant Roberts went.
Well, I think anything, the battle was so extreme that it took, you didn't care how extreme you had to be to protect the things that you cared about, because the smallest thing became, especially if it was lent to you by a friend, the most important thing in the world.
Well, and Stuart, I want to talk to you about some of your experiences briefly, too. I know that you were not captured that day with Augie and the other 11. You had been trying to save your feet from frostbite, those horrible winter conditions, one of the worst winters ever in Europe. But I understand that when you heard they were captured, it was such a big deal that you rushed out of the schoolhouse where you guys were holed up and you forgot something down there?
Yeah. I forgot my helmet. I actually heard them being captured because Godfrey was on the radio, the hand voice-powered radio, and we heard the whole thing when he was saying that one of our fellows had been shot in that trench, which we could almost see down the hill through the trees ahead of us, even though it was night. And shortly after that capture, when that phone went dead, and it was the last we heard of Godfrey until after the war.
And when he refers to Godfrey, that's the same Sergeant Roberts that we've been discussing.
Yeah, and we were, then all hell broke loose outside of the schoolhouse where we were hiding in the company or the platoon headquarters down there in the bottom of the schoolhouse. And Sergeant Godrow said, we're being attacked, everybody get up and, you know, grab something, and we're going to have to go into those woods and shoot whoever is there. And we went storming up the steps, and I just forgot my helmet, which I left in that cellar.
How long was it till you got another helmet?
Well, I'm not even sure that I did get another. I think I had no helmet, and I had my pants ripped off on a barbed wire fence. I don't think I ever recovered a helmet.
But you, after the war, and you were able to hold on to all your appendages despite the severe frostbite that you were facing. I know they wanted to amputate at one point, and you found a way to prevent them from doing that.
Yeah.
But you went into Hollywood and into the film business, had a very successful career, a legendary career as a screenwriter. And at one point, you went back to that same area where you had been when you were looking to make a movie back there. Is that correct?
Yep. Had Schnapp sitting looking out over this peaceful pasture, which had been the enemy front in front of us, right between the Siegfried line and our front lines, and just couldn't believe. But spring was coming, everything was gorgeous. And the teacher asked me, I told him that we had burst out of that cellar, and it was the last time I'd ever seen it. And I said, I'd love to go in the school and see what it's like with children in it. So he took me back into the place, and it was wonderful. The kids were singing, and then he took me down into the cellar. He said, maybe you want to see this again. And to go down those steps that I had last come up in 1944 just chilled me. And then he went into the corner, and he came back with a helmet full of nails, and he said, is this yours? And mine had been creased across the front of it. I don't know what had happened. It was dented, but it was my helmet. He said that he had a feeling that whoever left it there might someday come back, and he was waiting to give it back to me.
And I imagine that with all the friends that you have, who people would know and love from Hollywood and the unbelievable career you've had, I imagine that moment was as special for you as anything else that you've experienced.
Oh, it was. It was like the completion of a circle. But that whole visit to Hekushad that day was a remarkable one, because I had shot a boy from my position who had hung on the wire in front of it for 3 days until we got out of there. And I couldn't get close, or there was, you know, it was just war. And when I went into the village, I had a smell of death was everywhere. But my friend couldn't smell it, the guy who came with me. And I went back to that position where that kid had been stretched on the wire, and I just stopped and said a prayer there. And I'm not a very devout person, but the minute I had said the prayer for him, the smell of death went away.
Wow. That is a powerful story. Thank you for sharing that with us. And Stuart, thank you very much for your service to our country and for giving our culture such great legacies as well through your work as a screenwriter.
Give Augie my love.
He's still here. I was going to say, is there anything else that you think maybe he neglected to tell us that you want to embarrass him with while you're still together?
No.
I don't want to embarrass him anymore. I think I probably did enough.
Thank you, good buddy.
Okay.
Stuart Stern passed away in 2015, Augie Macaluso 5 years later, not long after Augie finally agreed to visit Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. He had turned down 18 previous opportunities to do so because he didn't want to spend 3 days away from his beloved wife, Ida. It's time for our first break, but still to come on this 800th episode of Hometown Heroes, how the story of the Doolittle Raiders will reach a whole new audience this fall, and a look into the future of this show and the stories you've heard here. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking episode number 800 of this program with gratitude to all of you who have listened and made it possible. World War II is a seemingly inexhaustible topic. The more you learn about it, the more you realize how much more there is to learn. And new generations are learning about it in different ways today. Come October, when the Air Force Academy squares off with the Naval Academy in college football, the story of the Doolittle Raid on Tokyo will reach a whole new audience because Air Force will be wearing some of the coolest uniforms I've ever seen. A Doolittle Raider-themed jersey and helmet combo complete with the serial numbers of the 16 B-25s that took off from the USS Hornet all those years ago. If you're a longtime Hometown Heroes listener, you may recall an episode from Missoula, Montana, with a Doolittle Raider named David Thatcher.
We had the Hornet and then two cruisers and four destroyers and a tanker. There was just eight in the task force when I left there. And we got just out of San Francisco a ways, and then they announced over the loudspeaker that our destination was Japan. And there was a huge shout went up over the whole aircraft carrier. No one had said anything about where we were going up until then.
Had you had your suspicions that it might be Japan? I'm sure that's where everyone wanted to attack.
We thought that's where we'd be going, yes.
And again, the genesis of this was got to find some way to strike back at the Japanese. Not as much for the physical damage, but for the psychological damage to show the Japanese they could be hit and give America a morale boost. I bet you didn't quite have that all figured out yet at that time.
Not at that time, no.
Anything of note that stands out to you between when you left the Golden Gate and when you got to that morning of April 18th when the mission actually happened?
The Navy wasn't very well pleased with having Army personnel aboard, but treated us pretty well. They let me sleep in a bed instead of a hammock.
So you get closer and closer to April 18th, and as I understand it, the events of that day actually got triggered sooner than they were supposed to. Surprise, surprise. Funny how that happens in war. Tell me how that developed.
Before that, we met up with another small task force, and it had the carrier Enterprise. It had also had two cruisers and four destroyers and a tanker. And Hornet could not launch or recover its aircraft while we were on board. So they had the Enterprise along to try and protect the task force from aerial fighting.
That's a pretty good security blanket. You know what the Big E went on to do the rest of the war and had been there at Pearl Harbor outside the harbor too. Well, let's move along to that morning, April 18th. Did you have any butterflies that day? How much did you know about what you guys were going to be doing? Walk us through that day as you experienced it.
Well, we knew what our target was. Each of the pilots got a chance to pick what target they wanted. So, and our target was the Nippon Steel Factory in Tokyo. But that morning, we heard the sort of explosion, the guns going off, and immediately they announced over the loudspeaker, "Army pilots, man your plane." So we had to get ready and go up on deck.
Did that get your blood pumping a little bit, get you excited?
Yes, it did.
I can imagine how it would. And as I understand it, Doolittle made the decision to leave 10 hours earlier because your task force had been detected. So this added 170 miles on a range that was already at its limit, right?
I think Bull Hall did pretty much made the decision that as long as we run into a Japanese fishing boat out there, that we're afraid they'd warn Japan that there was a task force out there. So we had to take off then.
What was it like on your crew as you guys took off? Did you have any idea how historic a mission this was going to be?
None whatever. We figured just another bombing mission.
But this is obviously your first mission.
Yes, for every one of us, yes.
So you weren't nervous at all?
Just pretty excited.
Was there anything that you guys did, maybe said something to each other, said a little prayer, talked about this or that, or were you all just keeping your mouth shut because you all knew what you were doing?
And had to concentrate on what we were doing, yes.
And what were your duties? I know the plane had 400 or 500-pound bombs, but you're on that top turret gun, so are you just looking for enemy aircraft to shoot at, or what?
I would just keep a lookout. I had 250 caliber machine guns in the turret, and I could see everything from up there in all directions, so I had a ringside seat.
So I've heard these B-25s, these heavily modified B-25s, described as flying gas cans. Was that something that you guys used as a characterization, or something that you've heard since?
Probably something heard since.
But you knew that crazy mission, that you were not going to make it back to the ship. Was that clear to you beforehand?
No way of ever coming back to the ship. We couldn't land on the aircraft carrier. We just had to go ahead.
So you were hoping to drop your bombs over Tokyo and land somewhere. And tell me about how this played out. What was it like approaching your target? What was the mood when the bombs were dropped, and what happened after that? I'll let you just tell the narrative for a little while.
Well, we were flying just 50 feet over the water. As we came in over the beach, it was Saturday, right at noon, a beautiful day, and there's hundreds of people along the beach. So as we flew overhead, they were waving to us. I could see the expressions on their faces. They were cheering. I'm sure they thought we were Japanese planes. After we left the coast, then before we got to Tokyo, we met a formation of six planes. But we were flying so low that it's difficult to see an airplane that's flying right over the ground. But the olive drab color they were, and they passed overhead, and I guess they didn't even see us. They just kept on going the direction we were coming.
But you saw them. You knew they were coming, so you were probably at the ready on your 50 calibers.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then before we got to Tokyo, we could see the anti-aircraft fire exploding because we did not go in formation. We went in alone. So six of the other airplanes had been ahead of us, so they drew the anti-aircraft fire. Then we had to climb to 1,500 feet to drop our bombs so they wouldn't blow us out of the air when they exploded. We had three 500-pound demolition and one 500-pound incendiary cluster. The three 500-pound demolition went at an angle down to the target, but the incendiary cluster, when it fell out of the airplane, it scattered into 126 individual bombs to scatter over the area that had been exploded from the other bombs, so to start fires. There was quite a bit of anti-aircraft fire over Tokyo itself, but it wasn't very accurate. I guess they hadn't had any practice yet.
Well, yeah, just like Pearl Harbor was a sneak attack, a surprise attack, this was every bit as much a surprise attack, and there were probably a lot of people, like you said, that thought they were Japanese planes. But I'm trying to put myself in your shoes and in your head, and you're already flying this flying gas can, as I said, with a range that it's not designed to make. You can't come back to the ship. You don't know where you're going to land. You see six planes coming at you. You know there's probably more. It sounds a lot like a suicide mission. Did that ever occur to you that this might be a suicide mission?
No, we didn't plan on that at all. We figured we could reach China all right, even though we had to take off 250 miles farther out than we'd planned to. Our original plan was to take off in the evening and fly over Japan at night and reach China the next morning after daylight. As it was, we had to take off at 9 in the morning. We rode over Japan in the daytime and then finally arrived on the coast of China. It was about dark.
I'm really intrigued by that period of time between when you dropped the bombs and when you landed, or crash landed as the case happened to be. At what point did you realize this is it? The gas has run out, or we've got to put it down. Was there any discussion among the crew? Did you guys just all trust Lawson to handle it, or what were those moments like?
No, we figured he could handle it, whether we tried to land in the water or fly up high and bail out.
When did you find out that he was going to put it in the water, that this was it? And tell our listeners where that was and how that all happened.
Well, we finally reached what we saw land, and he spotted a strip of beach, and he thought they could set it down there. So we had the wheel down, but it was almost dark and raining, and visibility was poor. And we hit the water with the wheel down, and immediately stopped us and turned us over.
What did that feel like? I can't imagine.
Well, I was knocked unconscious for a while, and I was in the back of the airplane. The other four were all thrown out through the nose of the airplane. When I came to in the back of the airplane, I wasn't completely conscious, and I could see water coming in what I thought was the bottom of the airplane. So I tried to get out there, and then come to realize the plane was upside down, and the plexiglass on the turret had shattered. That's where the water was coming in. So I was able to go back and open the escape hatch on the bottom of the airplane, crawled out on the belly of the airplane.
Which was now the top.
Yes. And then walked back towards the tail of the airplane, and when I stepped off in the water, it was about waist deep. So I was able to wade to shore. By that time, the other four crew were already up on the shore. They were very seriously injured, and there's some people up on a bank there, and they heard the crash, so they came down there, and we didn't know if they were Chinese or Japanese, but the first thing they wanted to know, we couldn't understand it, but they pointed to the fingers on their hand, and then they pointed to each one of us, and then they pointed out to the airplane. So they figured by that they wanted to know if there was just the five of us in there. So then they helped us up to a little village there overnight.
I don't want to interrupt you here, but I know that you, like every veteran I've interviewed, are very humble about what you did. But the government gave you a Silver Star for what you did. And tell me what you did with the other four men, because from what I've read, you had to help them significantly with first aid and making sure that they'd got off that beach.
We went down on a Japanese-occupied island off the coast of China. But the underground there helped us get out of there. And the next morning, then, none of the four of them could walk, so they had to be carried on makeshift stretchers. We had to cross the island, so they used a bamboo, sort of a bamboo pallet to tie up to a bamboo pole so two coolies could carry each one of the guys on their shoulders. And the guerrilla leader on the island there, before I left, I went back to the airplane after daylight and tried to find a first aid kit. But then I saw that the airplane was upside down, the main landing gear was sticking up in the air, and the engines and propellers were quite a ways out in the water. But we must have hit the bottom when we crashed, because the full front end of the airplane, clear back to the leading edge of the wings, was smashed flat. So if they hadn't been thrown out, they'd have never got out alive.
So were you able to find some materials to render first aid?
No, I couldn't find anything but packs of cigarettes floating around in the plane.
That might have made someone feel a little better, but it wasn't going to do a whole lot of good. So you, along with these Chinese nationals, helped the injured guys. You weren't banged up at all? I know you were just not even 21 yet, just 20 years old, but you weren't hurt at all?
I was had a pretty bad bump on the top of my head from... That's what knocked me unconscious, I guess. But otherwise than that, I was not hurt.
So what's going through your mind at this point? I mean, there are so many moments where you probably thought this could be it, but did you think you were going to get out of there alive? I mean, I can't imagine what it must have been like to you in that situation.
We didn't know if we would or not. If it hadn't been the Chinese, we'd have been captured.
How did they get you out of there and back to Allied forces?
We left that spot where we crashed at 11 o'clock in the morning. We found out later that the Japanese landed 65 Jap soldiers, and they came looking for us, but we had a head start on them. Had to go all the way across the island and went by a sampan then to the mainland. It took us 2 days to get to free territory, at the little town of Haiyu on the coast. Then it took us another day to reach a hospital. They had to be carried all that time.
I imagine everyone's getting pretty exhausted and probably pretty hungry by now, too.
Well, we did have some food, but they were in pain all the time because we didn't have and had nothing to relieve their pain. Or
would you say that that's something, I'm sure the crew was close ahead of time, but at this point, do you think it brought the crew closer together to be going through this incredible ordeal together?
Yes, I'm sure it did, yes.
So what happened next? Where did they take you from there?
From the hospital, they got to the hospital, and there, we were there at Lynn Hyatt for 3 days, and then another crew made a good water landing on an island out farther than we were. The airplane floated for 8 minutes, and they were able to, they had the only medical doctor that was on the raid with them, and they were able to get his black bag out and get the stuff into the life raft. But in landing in the water, a sharp edge of one of the flaps had turned up. As they pushed the life raft off the wing, it punctured one half the life raft and dumped everything in the water. So they were able to cling to the raft to get ashore. And they came to the island of Dandine where we were, and my co-pilot, Dean Davenport, had given his passport to the guerrilla leader on the island, so they knew we were ahead of them and needed medical attention. So they caught up with us at Lynn High 3 days after we got there. And then I went on with their crew because I was no more used to my crew, and the docs twice stayed with their crew to take care of them.
And all this time, I'm sure none of you had any idea how successful your raid was or what kind of significance it would have or what happened to all the other crews, right?
That's right. We didn't hear until we got a big city on the Yangtze River, Hanyang. We finally found out about the other crews there. So then I went on with that crew, and it took us a couple more days of pretty much walking and being carried in sedan chairs. The Chinese had blown up all the roads along the coast to slow the advance of the Japanese. So all there was trails down through the rice paddies that traveled.
This is not what you imagined when you're a Montana boy signing up for the Army Air Corps. What was that moment like when you finally saw American officers and enlisted men again and realized, you know what, I'm not going to spend the rest of this as a POW?
Well, at Lynn High, there was an English missionary and his wife, and they could translate for us then, so that helped a lot. We finally reached Hanyang, and a good-sized city, after traveling almost every means of transportation you could think of. They had an airbase there. So we waited 3 days for an airplane to come in from Chongqing to pick us up. And those 3 days, the Japanese would come over and bomb the city and bomb the airport because the Chinese didn't have anything to shoot us at them with. Every day we'd go up the river in a tug and get out on the shore and hike up to a pagoda on the top of a hill there. The fourth morning they came in and picked us up, the airplane got in. Well, that day, the Japanese came over and bombed and strafed that pagoda. They knew what we were doing. They had spies through there.
Man, close call after close call after close call. And one of the things that's most incredible to me is that so many survived. There were only a few, I believe, 8 ended up as prisoners of war. 3 were executed by the Japanese, which is a great tragedy. But the other tragedy in this, the Chinese that helped you. I've read as many as 250,000 civilians were killed by the Japanese to punish them for helping you?
Mm-hmm. They went through, and as they kept advancing, they'd wipe out the towns and villages that helped us, any of them. Yes.
I imagine that just has to really be hard to deal with and hard to swallow, and makes you that much more grateful to those people who did help you, who saved your life. And in the end, I imagine a lot of the people that helped you probably died, right?
Yes, that's for sure. I'm sure they did, yes.
I didn't ask you about the movie that came out, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. When that happened, when it came out, the war's still going on. Was it kind of a neat thing for you to see yourself on the silver screen?
When I came back from North Africa in January 43, I was stationed at Santa Monica, and I got to visit the MGM studios and meet all the crew that in the movie. That was quite interesting.
Once you got married, I imagine your wife enjoyed these reunions as much as you did.
Yes, we've been to a lot of the reunions throughout the United States seem like.
People that go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and the National Air Force Museum there can see some of this, but you have some very special goblets that you drink a toast out of every year at these reunions. Tell me about that.
There are 80 goblets in a case that all of them have a name right when they're turned right side up or when they're upside down. You can read our names on them, one for each member of the Raiders. And we drink a toast to all those that have gone before us. And then if any Raiders have died in the past year, their goblets are turned upside down at that reunion.
You've done this dozens of times, but I have a feeling that every year it's probably still a pretty emotional moment for you, is it?
Yes, as through the years, the number of Raiders has diminished quite fast, really.
And I've heard of this tradition with some other reunion groups, too. When it gets down to the last two guys at the reunion, tell me what you're going to do.
Well, there's a bottle of liquor that we're supposed to open it and drink a toast to all those that have passed on at the last reunion on two survivors.
David Thatcher was one of the last two surviving Doolittle Raiders and did indeed participate in that toast. The story of those goblets will be included in the effort to connect that incredible chapter of history with a whole new generation when Air Force meets Navy on the gridiron in October. And speaking of reaching younger generations, I've got some exciting news to share about these veteran stories. Perhaps you can be a part of making this vision a reality. We'll talk about it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our 800th episode. When a program director named Skip Essick gave us the green light for episode numero uno, I don't think any of us were sure how it was going to be received. What a blessing it's been to bring these veteran stories to you over the years. We're hoping for 800 more. And in a moment, I'm going to give you a sneak peek of our next episode, one of the most amazing World War II survival stories I've heard. But first, I want to play for you what they refer to as the teaser for a new project called Retold World War II. Sometimes we're afraid to talk about things until they're a finished product, and this isn't finished quite yet. But I've always viewed this as we're all in this together. It was listeners of this program who encouraged me to start an honor flight in Central California where I live, and we talked about that here on the radio before it ever became a reality. A decade later, Central Valley Honor Flight is about to pass 1,700 veterans taken to Washington, D.C., and if you're in my neck of the woods, you can welcome the latest crop of veterans home on September 13th. And here's another opportunity for you to help us take an idea from concept to reality. I was approached by some friends with experience in the world of audio drama about turning some of these World War II veteran stories into a podcast in which their firsthand accounts combine with scripted dialogue and the best voice actors in the business to bring their stories to life in a whole new way. A way in which young people might more readily engage and thus absorb a new perspective on the price of freedom. Here's a little taste of what Retold World War II will sound like.
First place, we started off, you're right, at 25, and then they raised it to 30. And then after 30, they said, we'll never fly more than 35. They were certainly right in my case, because, you know, if we do get the crews in, we were still losing a lot of crews, you know, you will not have to go to the 35th mission. Well, we did. And the 35th mission, which was our last, really and truly was our last.
All right, you apes, let's dump these eggs so I can go home back to Betsy.
I've been meaning to tell you, Russia.
Don't call me Russia.
I got a letter from your Betsy. Something about some 4F guy down the street named Charlie.
Aren't you a ray of sunshine?
Hey, I do my best.
How do you get by without your mommy rocking you to sleep every night?
You worked all day on that one, didn't you?
You guys. Every mission, the same thing.
Hey, he started it.
All right, listen up, fellas. This is a milk run, quick and simple. After this, we've done enough missions to go home.
Sounds good to me.
But the Jerrys, well, they don't know that. They're going to be right on our tail the whole time, understood?
What did I ever do to them?
Probably annoyed them, like you do everyone else.
All right, here we go. Stay frosty, boys. Keep your eyes and ears open.
Yes, sir.
What happened is there was several bursts of flak, and we got hit on our number one and number two engine, and the hydraulic system failed.
We're hit. Time to bail. I'll hold her as long as I can. See you on the deck.
Old days.
Everything was failing. There was fire coming into the ship. So we had to bail out. I was in the nose of the plane, so I jumped through the nose wheel door. And fortunately, every one of us got out of the plane before it exploded. I got rid of my dog tags because I'm Jewish, and it had H on there. So, knowing where I was going, I decided the best thing I could do was get rid of my dog tags, because they were shooting at me as I was coming down, so there was no way they could say I was a spy that they had picked up in the country. And I did land right in the German front lines, and I was captured immediately.
Get down on the count! Put your
Nick Schiessen! Nick Schiessen!
Who are you, American? What is your mission?
Stavrov, Erwin, Lieutenant, T-163-342.
Where are your dog tags, Stavrov? Are you a spy?
Stavrov, Erwin, Lieutenant, T-163-342.
Listen to me, Lieutenant Stavrov. Your mother's name is Bertha. Your father's is Max. You have a brother and
how do you know? Stavrov, Erwin, Lieutenant, T-163-342.
Oh, that's right. I know all about you. You lived on Claremont Avenue in Buffalo, New York, huh? You attended public school number 56, and I know your homecoming date was a brunette named Betsy Parker. And best of all, I know you are a Jew, right, Lieutenant?
What? How could you...
No.
My name is Stavrov Erwin, T-163-342.
Germany welcomes you, Lieutenant Stavrov. I'm afraid for you, the war is over.
So again, that's the teaser for Retold World War II, a work in progress that will require some funding if indeed the top talent in the audio drama field are going to participate. I believe God's plans are always better than our plans, and his timing is perfect. And if you'd like to be part of making that project a reality, you can visit retoldpodcast.com. I also have it linked at hometownheroesradio.com. So we're putting it out there, and we will see what happens. One thing I know will happen is next week when you turn into Hometown Heroes for episode episode number 801, you're going to hear one of the craziest survival stories you've ever tried to fathom from 97-year-old Richard Burbine of Bridgeport, California. Here's just a few minutes to whet your appetite. He was in the Merchant Marines serving aboard the last American ship to be sunk by German aircraft in World War II, the SS Henry Bacon.
February 23rd, 1945, the ship was 60 miles from the normal convoy. We hit a severe storm that destroyed our steering mechanism. The rudder and the main springs from the hydraulics split and broke. My job was at the time was pick up that 150-pound spring, put it back on, try to hold it in place while they were navigating the ship. We were a hazard to the convoy, so we had to drop out of the convoy. We were by ourselves 60 miles away from the convoy. So if anything happened, they would get us, but they would not destroy the convoy. And that's what happened. The KG-26 found us with 23 Ju-88 torpedo bombers, one solitary ship. It was touch and go. What they did was they flew left or port or starboard of the ship. One row would float down the left or the starboard or port side of the ship and strafe everything one way. The other one would come in the other direction and strafe the other way. So consequently, when they did torpedo us, they shot they hit us in number 5 hole and blew the whole side of the ship out at that point. We were under general armor for that time, and everybody's at their battle stations and whatnot. So what happened was, after blowing a hole into the ship, we had a matter of minutes before the ship was going to sink, because as the ship was going down, it was blowing the bulkheads out between the hatches and so on. And I was ordered by the chief engineer, Donald Haviland, my chief engineer. He was a full commander, 3-striper. To get into the lifeboat, and the lifeboats were all shot to pieces except for that one lifeboat was still in fairly good shape. It had a few holes in it, strafe holes in it, but it was still seaworthy. The other ones were just about shattered. So he ordered me in there to cut the lanyards because it was frozen to the davits of the lifeboat. You see what davits are? Mm-hmm. And the lines were frozen to it, so the lifeboat would not go down by itself mechanically. So I got in the lifeboat with a fire axe, and I chopped one line down, and the stern was okay. Just as I was cutting the bow of the lifeboat, a sea hit us, and the lifeboat and I went over the side. Well, when I came to, I was in the bow of the lifeboat, and the lifeboat come down the back of my neck, and I still have that hump in my neck to this day. But anyway, I came to in the lifeboat, kicked my sea boots out, and I was able to right the lifeboat. The lifeboat was upside down. I was able to right it. And consequently, that's where they put all the Norwegian, 19 women, 19 children, the list is up there, into the lifeboat. And they wanted me to get in. Well, I knew that was crazy. If I got in that lifeboat, I would freeze almost instantaneously because I was soaking wet. So I said, no, I will not get in the lifeboat, and I stayed in the water. And I got the picture of the life ring, that I was able to get the life ring. And during all this commotion, one minute I'd be 60, 80 feet in the air on top of a wave, on the crest of a wave, and the wave would break and I'd be down 60 feet below the water line. And I saw 2 seamen, a friend of mine, and I was able to push the lifeboat, swim with the lifeboat over to them, and I was able to save both of them. One of his name was William Wildridge, and the other one was Woodrow Wilson Posen, and one Navy gunner by the name of Warren Batchelor. And I was able to save all 3 of them. So, and when they picked us up, they took them aboard. When they dropped me on the deck, my eyes opened. They said, my God, they're still alive. And that's how they knew we were all still alive.
And that is just the tip of the iceberg. No pun intended. We're going to hear that entire story next time as we embark on what I hope will be another 800 episodes. Thanks for sticking around for the first 800. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.